Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Welcome to Let's Talk Liberty. This is Terry Dodd. I'm on with my good friend and co-host tonight, Red Beckman. We've got a really exciting show tonight. I believe it's going to be very informative for everyone that's listening, including us. And we've got a great guest coming on with us tonight, and I look forward to that. Red, are you on with me?
I'm present and accounted for.
Ready to rock and roll, huh?
I am.
Red, would you like for me to open us in prayer, or would you like to do that?
I can do that.
Please do.
Heavenly Father, we come to Thee knowing our inadequacies, knowing that without Your help, we are nothing. We just ask that You give us of Your strength and of Your wisdom. Pardon me. We thank You, dear Lord, because we can come to You knowing that You hear. You hear what we have to ask in our petitions. We petition, O Lord, for the future of our nation. Our nation has fallen by the wayside. We have sinned, and we have become evil and wicked, and we know that You are very concerned about the future of this nation. We just pray, O Lord, that You would help us. We ask of Your wisdom. You said, You promised that if we asked, You would give us wisdom. We need that wisdom. This is a big, big job that we've got to try to get this nation back on track. With Your help, it's possible. Can be done. And we just pray that You would have mercy on us. Forgive us our sins, our trespasses. We just pray now that You will take a special interest in the program we have here, that we bring a program that people will be enriched by. And we just pray now that we don't say anything that's not pleasing to You. In Christ's name we ask this all. Amen.
Amen. I hope I was muted a while ago when I made some comment. I hope that didn't come across in the middle of that prayer. Our guest is on with us already. Red, I'd like to introduce you and our listeners to Mr. Mike DeCosola, who is from Illinois. And Mike, are you there?
Yes, I am, Terry. Thanks.
Well, I really appreciate you joining us tonight, especially on the short notice. I really enjoyed our conversation earlier today, and I'm really looking forward to you and Red being able to have a really good exchange tonight. Mike, can you start out by telling us just a little bit about the county assemblies? I know that you're a very active member, possibly a coordinator for the Illinois County Assemblies, and it would be a good way maybe to introduce who you are and let our listeners have a little idea of your background.
Okay, not a problem. First off, I'd like to thank you for having me on your show, and it is it's very important that we try to open up and express to everybody, you know, where the authority comes from. Right now, Illinois has an Illinois County Assembly. Our meets and bounds are the borders of Illinois, and as we speak, we're getting our foundation structured in order for us to go ahead and have enough members where we could start breaking down the Illinois County Assembly down to counties, and they are all considered at large. So when we deal at large, we're dealing with the counties at large, and we call those judicial districts of 10. Now, what we're doing is we are sitting in a position right now where everybody throughout the country is all looking for a remedy, but we're asking our public servants for grievance, and they haven't given it to us in 234 years because they're sitting in a de facto position. The position that they're sitting in is something what we call a de facto office or a color of office or color of law. It's a occupied position that is done unlawfully and illegally, but it's a position that's been around since, you know, the beginning. And when I say the beginning, I mean since Congress got up and walked out during Lincoln's presidency. And that's when he came aboard and he did his de facto Congress. Right now, the dilemma across the country is how do we go about making our delegates? And the Continental Congress has done a great job organizing that. Right now, you know, in looking at your infrastructure, things are done properly. We have to go back to the Articles of Confederation, where they say a minimum of 2 delegates to a maximum of 7 can be appointed by the people from the ground up at the county level. And
well, do we have dead air, or is it just me?
I'm here yet, but you're the only one I hear.
Yeah, Mike, it seems like you dropped off. And Janet, is he still on the board? I'm not hearing. He's gone. He'll have to call back in. I'm sure he'll call back in shortly. Well, Red, you're a little bit familiar with these county assemblies, and basically what they're doing is that they're trying to recreate, reestablish, if you will, the de jure governments on a county level. And I believe, Mike, are you back on with us now? Mike, are you there? Red, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes, sir. Welcome back. We lost you.
Yeah, I'm on a cell phone because I'm not at the house, so I apologize, and it's dropping the call. I'm having a bad connection for some reason. There's a lot of thunderstorms going over here.
That's okay. We hear you loud and clear. You've got a good connection.
Okay, great, great. So right now, what's happening is, from what I understand, you have all dedicated about 14 years to showing your grievances, you know, in methodical order and them being ignored. But what's happening right now is the government and several different patriot organizations have different remedies that they feel are suitable. Boy, it's pouring over here, so I apologize if you hear a lot of background noise. So what we're trying to achieve right now is we're trying to get the exposure of letting people know that the power starts at the bottom. Under the laws of purity, it starts from the bottom up, and it doesn't go from the top down. And this is where the problem starts and ends. Once we as a community can actually take responsibility for our local areas, and then do it in the de jure where there's a vacant position. A good analogy would be, as an example, if you have a house on your street, on the left side is a vacant lot, and on the right side is your neighbor's home. If you go, let's picture that neighbor's home to be a federal municipal corporation, and you decide that you've had it with the way they've been acting next door, and you decide to go knock on that door and say, I'm stepping in, here's the rules, I'm taking over your house. Well, it would make us no different than who they are, you know, and they are tyrants at this point. So what we're trying to do is let you know that there's a vacant lot on the left side of your house,
with a blueprint already made out by the forefathers and the Articles of Confederation and, you know, the Declaration of Independence. And basically this blueprint says you have a vacant spot. It's yours. You don't have to go next door and take their house. Let their house be, because they're a de facto and you're a higher superior authority if you stay in the de jure. When we stay in the de facto, we're not acting in the form of the lawful republic. We're acting in the form of legal versus lawful. And if you look up legal is illegal, you know, and it's immoral, whereas lawful is substantive. And it stems our true authority from the Articles of Confederation. So what a lot of people are looking at is the word confederation has always been coined as an opposite of its name. In other words, we think of the Confederates and we think of it being a bad coined name, just as we would think of the word assembly being coined bad or the word militia being coined bad. But these are all words that are used in our constitutions and our Declaration of Independence and our Articles of Confederation. So they were good words at one time, but they programmed us to think they're bad words. So everything that had remedy, they've had everything that confined us or put us in a bad position, they coined as good. So what we're just trying to do is open up the possibilities of what we can do as a county assembly by appointing our own judicial judges in our own district. I mean, if you go to Title 28 of the United States Code, it talks about the District Court of the United States. That is where your remedy is. It's not in the United States District Court. When people go to municipal courts and they lose their homes and they're fighting and they can't understand why they're being railroaded because they don't have to adhere to their own rules. They don't listen to their federal rules of evidence because they can use the hearsay rule. They don't have to adhere to any of their own United States codes, but it's their codes. It's not your codes. As a sovereign, you have your own state rules and what you agree to adopt. So if you agree to adopt the rules of the de facto, then you're subject to the de facto. Guys, I'm just going to give me about 5 minutes. I'm going to be home. I'm going to put this on hold because the rain is really bad right now. And I will get right back on. Can you bear with me?
Yes, sir. We'll be glad to.
Okay, thank you.
Well, Red?
Yes.
Do you have any comment to what Mike just shared with us?
Well, I am inclined to believe it's a long ways up that hill. We have to remember that in excess of 95% of our Americans, our fellow countrymen, are totally oblivious to what is really going on, how the system was designed, or anything else. And I think that most of our efforts need to be focused on trying to get as many of those people deprogrammed and get them to a position where they would like to know the truth, where get them deprogrammed to understand that what they know about government is what they were taught by government, and governments aren't known for teaching people how to be good citizens and how to control government. So, I don't know a great deal about these assemblies, but I do know this. A number of people involved are very small at this point in time, and I don't know how many people are ready to break the doors down and get involved. I don't see that at this point. It's a major undertaking, and of course, you know, hope everything is possible. And that's why I just keep insisting that there's no way we can put this thing together without God's help, because it is a massive job. It's just, you know, it's bigger than we are. Let me put it that way. The job that we have to do is bigger than we are, and we're just going to have a lot of divine intervention and a lot of divine help to put this thing back on track. But, you know, if we can have enough repentance in this country, we'll win this thing, and we'll win it, you know, in great style, and not too many people get hurt or anything else. And, you know, the last thing we want is a bloody revolution in the streets. That's just an insanity. And as I said in a couple of my books, a bloody revolution is the evidence of failure. Failure on the part of the people to understand what's going on around them and understand how to maintain an orderly society. So anyway, and of course, I'm reminded almost on a daily basis here how that perhaps the biggest problem we have in this country, the reason that we have gone downhill so bad, is coming right out of the pulpits in our churches. And, you know, they're teaching that we are subjects to higher power. And that is so contrary to the scripture. And they say that the government is the higher power. And if you're a subject, you're a slave. And that's what we are, basically, in this country. It's just that we're not smart enough to know that we're being enslaved. Now you should put in your two cents worth.
Well, one of the things that, you know, and I know that it's a long haul, but the good news about this county assembly thing, the thing that I like about it, is that it's a true grassroots movement. And you're a little bit aware of that, I believe, aren't you, Red, from your discussion with your buddy Saints?
The problem, of course, is that that I suspicion that they can be infiltrated, and from some of the scuttlebutt that I've heard or seen on the internet, it's already apparent that they've had some infiltration coming from government provocateurs, and we're not going to get away from that in any kind of a effort that we make. We're not gonna be immune from government messing with our programs.
Yeah, but it seems like they're more prevalent in the top down stuff than they are the grassroots. At least when you're dealing with your neighbors and people, I mean, you're still gonna run into infiltrators even in your neighborhoods, but. At least you got a better shot at having a longer track record with somebody.
Yeah, well, we have to really stress to the people out here that these negative voices that we're hearing, most of them are government hirelings. They're provocateurs, and they're paid to do what they're doing. And so once we, isolate these people that are so negative once we isolate them, then we can proceed and go forward.
Red, well, Mike is back on. Mike is back on live. Mike, welcome back. Hope you made it home safe.
Yeah, it was crazy. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, it just started hailing over here. but I'm home. Thank you.
Well, Mike, earlier when we were talking, you mentioned that you have been doing seminars explaining the lawful method for pulling your remedies in court from a municipal level to a federal level. Can you elaborate and kind of tell us what that's about?
Absolutely. Well, what is transpiring in the courthouses is they're using Administrative Procedures Act to handle all the affairs of most foreclosures throughout the municipalities. And under Article 1, there is a part that will talk about the piracies that might be committed, and it defines basically what piracies are. You know, it says define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the laws of nations. Piracy is alive and well. It's not the guy with the eye cover on any longer. What it is inland piracy. And inland piracy is basically admiralty law that pirates of the high seas in commerce are using vessels such as our persons. Our persons are our name in all capital letters. Those are considered vessels because they are corporations. And under Title 46, it will define that as persons being corporations and vessels. And if you look at Title 28 of 3002, subsection, it'll define persons again as corporations. So what happens is they're using these corporations as subsidiaries of the mother corporation called United States, Inc. And they're using the Administrative Procedures Act to attack through what we call collateral attack all of the people's homes by way of foreclosure. These parties that are suing, though, are not the real parties of interest. They're of course, these attorneys and law firms that are suing on behalf of banks who are not the real party of interest, which Federal Rules of Civil Procedure requires a real party of interest. And they're not having to support their actual lawsuit with substantive evidence, because when you're in a municipal court, and this is where we kind of left off, municipal courts do not have to adhere to the Federal Rules of Evidence. So they can use hearsay as a way and means to be able to support their claim. But whenever they're doing a claim against you, they fail to state a claim where relief can be granted, and that's under Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 12, because the reason why they're failing to state a claim where relief can be granted is because there's no way to pay off debt. There's no money under HGR 192. They took it. You can't pay off debt. You can only discharge it. So with that, there's no real injured party also, and they're using a copy of your promissory note that you actually signed. It's yours. You created the money. It's a unilateral contract. Their signature is not on it, so there's no value consideration. So you have no full disclosure. There hasn't been, you know, any proper due process. They're completely ignoring anybody's request to see that they're the holder in due course of the promissory note, because they only have to adhere to the hearsay rule, which is, here's a copy of the promissory note. This is his debt. He's in default. But the mere fact is they don't have to adhere to the Federal Rules of Evidence. They are out of jurisdiction as well. They are limited to their jurisdiction whenever jurisdiction is challenged. So when you come in there and you state that you're a sovereign, the very first thing that has to happen from that point on, before ratification and commencement can begin, is you need to have the plaintiff who's initially creating the action of suit prove up that jurisdiction is proper. Plus, if you have to have proof of claim, that means you have to show you're the holder in due course. But because all he needs is a copy of your security instrument that you created, which is your promissory note at closing, the judge accepts that for what it is to be substantive enough. When it's not substantive, it's hearsay. Now, when you're dealing with the promissory note in federal court, you can demand to see the actual promissory note. And substantive evidence must be produced. Plus, if you're challenging jurisdiction in admiralty, you wind up with exclusive jurisdiction in federal court, because they're acting under the Buck Act, under all the abbreviations, IL for Illinois, you know, California CA. Those are all federal zones, federal postal zones that are virtual government locations that kind of have like a virtual reality, you know, a see-through map, so to speak, that overlays the 50 states. And so when they're dealing with the federal states in the acronyms like IL, for example, for Illinois, you're dealing as a federal employee. And so when you state that you're a United States citizen,
you're in their jurisdiction. But if you look at 3,200 Title 28 USC, you're going to find out that a U.S. citizen is under the District of Columbia, and so is the capital S for state. But the lowercase s represents the several statute states of the union. So as you can see, they started messing with upper and lowercase s's for states. They started messing with color of words, color of law. They mirrored everything. You know, it's funny because the devil can never create. That was the one thing that God wouldn't let him do. But the devil can imitate, can mirror, and everything that we do is mirrored. When you're born, they took your birthright name, your baptismal name, your God-given name, and they mirrored it with an all-capital corporation name. Now, by doing that, all they had to do is convince you to be the surety guarantee for it. So voluntarily, all you have to do is just believe that you are the all-capital name, and now you've basically turned yourself into a fiction corporation. So there's all these tricks that they do in court to get you into their jurisdiction. But in the municipal court, it's gotten so out of hand, once you challenge jurisdiction, it is limited. They must force the plaintiff to prove that they have jurisdiction. If they don't do that, even if there is a default judgment against you, even if there is a summary judgment against you, it's void because it was done without proper ratification and commencement. It was acquiescence and adjudicated into their jurisdiction incorrectly because they didn't address the first issue. You are challenging jurisdiction. So where do you get your remedy then if you can't do it in municipal court? You got to bring it to federal court, and you got to do it through a counterclaim. These counterclaims, if you look it up in the Black Law Dictionary, counterclaim is a set-off and discharge. So you're balancing the books by simply counterclaiming. And if you look up the word set-off, you'll see that set-off is discharge. So under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, you are actually mandated to file a counterclaim in order to set off the balance of the books, because the judge is there not as a judge but as an administrator to balance both sides of the books. And you can't get that remedy in municipal court. You have to bring that into federal court and have them set off the books by you doing the counterclaim. You got to do
Mike,
a notice.
Mike, before we pass out the duct tape to our listeners so that their heads will stop exploding, I want to just slow you down for a half a second. Some people, you know, we've come up against and with and shared discussions with a lot of these 14th Amendment people who have made similar statements about, you know, the all caps, et cetera, some of which has made perfectly good sense. But a lot of these people have not really gotten a lot of experience with this. They don't have the background. They keep looking for silver bullets, for example, and this is one of the things that they've thrown out. And they've actually gotten some people have ended up thrown in jail using this type of defense. And I know that you've got some experience here, and you've been doing this, and you've actually had some success. So you might want to spend just a second giving a little bit of background about that and how you came to this level of knowledge. So that the listeners don't just perceive you as another one of these silver bullet people out there giving advice to somebody else that they're not putting into practical application.
Well, and I totally understand that. And whatever I teach, I actually do. Whenever I'm talking about something that I have a theory on, people that I'm telling it to will know that. But what I've expressed to you just now is something that I've done in federal courts. You know, I've actually, you know, been in court on both municipal level and federal level with regards to foreclosure. You know, we just won a municipal foreclosure, which is very difficult. We won that free and clear in Illinois. We're now selling the house. But that was basically by us winning before we ever showed up for court. Whole different method. If it would have went any further, we would have done a notice of removal. I have tested both commercial on equipment loans as well as commercial buildings. There was a case that I was handling on one of my own properties. It was a commercial equipment loan for a little over $780,000. I had a factory. And basically, we went to federal court from municipal. I removed it. And when I stated my name, you know, I said, my name is Mike DeCosla, upper lowercase, real sovereign man. I'm here in special, restricted, limited appearance under sua juris. And she stopped me. And she said, ah, you're the sovereign guy. Looked over at the plaintiff's attorney and said, do you know this man? And he said, yes, I do. He's the defendant. Now, mind you, I came in when I removed it and made myself the plaintiff under counterclaim, but they're still recognizing me only as a defendant at the time. And she said, well, you know, what's going on? He says, I want this case remanded back to the state. He doesn't belong there. Now, the reason why people aren't doing this right is because they don't understand the laws that have to support what you're doing, because you cannot, you have to first bring up a federal question. A lot of people have heard about these negative averments that are being trained all over the place. Those are legitimate methods of actually challenging in a counterclaim by negative averment and in admiralty. But you have to use the Uniform Commercial, I'm sorry, the USC code under Title 28. It's 1331. And 1331 says, is there a federal question? So in that case, using that as an example, the federal question was, are you under 1332 a foreign state suing another foreign state? Well, if I just explained to you under the Buck Act that IL stands for the federal virtual state under capital S, and I'm on the organic soil of the Illinois state lower S, then would you presume that that would be two different states? Yes or no? The answer would be yes. And the reason why is because you're talking one for the District of Columbia and you're talking the other one for the actual organic state. So what happens under 1332 is you fall under Category 3, which is there a federal question under 1331? Yes. The federal question is there exclusivity for your case in federal court? Well, the only way to get that answer is by looking at 1332, which is your diversification of citizenship. And is there two different states from two different foreign states involved? And yes, there is. You're on the organic true soil of the de jure, and they're in the de facto fake virtual state. And so basically you have two foreign states, which is theirs being the District of Columbia. Now, when you do your counterclaim, you're doing it in admiralty. So under admiralty, if you're not learned in law, you basically go under the saving to the suitors clause. Under the saving to the suitors clause in 1333 under Title 28, you have the right to remove the case into federal court, so now you've appeased the first question. Is there exclusivity in the federal court? And there is. So now you've achieved jurisdiction. Once you have jurisdiction, you have to make sure that you title the documents correctly. Because if you went into the federal court's going to give you all the forms and say, here, put your complaint under the U.S. District Court. And everything will be titled as that. But that's all a trick because that all relates to the District of Columbia. In order to get remedy, you have to get through admiralty. And in order to get to common law, you have to go through admiralty to get to common law. So basically, your constitutional rights and the admiralty law are almost intertwined. So you use the saving to the suitor clause in order to access common law through admiralty. And what is that common law right that you're using? You're using the law of contracts, because when you did a counterclaim, you did it as an affidavit, which under the Supreme Court ruling, they cannot contest, expunge, or strike an affidavit. They have to answer it or it becomes fact, truth, and they go into dishonor. So that's the first part of your counterclaim is the word affidavit on the title. Negative averment means you're opposing what they're saying in your counts in positive law, even though it's negative in form. So that's negative averment. And you're saying, I don't believe there's any evidence to the contrary. So you're giving them an opportunity to cure. So now it's affidavit of negative averment, opportunity to cure. Now, why do you want an opportunity to cure for them? Because under the Supreme Court rule, an opportunity to cure means you're giving them 20-day grace period, for example, to answer you or rebut you. If they don't do that,
you've given them forbearance. And under Supreme Court rulings, forbearance means you have given value. So value consideration, believe it or not, is your grace period. So when you give a grace period to somebody and say, look, I won't sue you so long as you put us back whole again within this 20-day grace period, that or value consideration. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Something was clicking. I'm not sure what it was. It was
okay.
And it was kind of cutting you out when it clicked. So,
yeah,
Red, I know you got some things running through your mind. I'd like for you to kind of carry the conversation with Mike, if you would, please.
Well, the problem, of course, is that there's too few out there with the talent that Mike has. You know, and the presence to go into court and maintain and be able to think on their feet. Too many people go into court and they're just so intimidated and so rattled to the point where they can't think very well. I'm going to have to clear my throat here.
Go ahead, Mike. One of the things that's come to my mind is that a lot of the people that I know of that have had not very good success with the sort of methods that you're talking about, they've been in there on tax issues rather than foreclosure issues. And I'm wondering if this translates over, or if what you're doing is setting any kind of a precedent that could be applied or utilized in the tax situation.
That's a good question, Terry. And the answer is you are a sovereign, which means under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, you are immune from these frivolous filing suits. So, and that's also in Title 28. Because you, as a sovereign, you're a foreign nation, and they are trading with the enemy under the Trading with the Enemy Act. They're the strangers, not us. But they make us believe that we are the strangers in their land, when really they're from the District of Columbia, which is Guam, Samoa, Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, Washington, D.C., America, Somalia, none of which are the statutes, you know, the 50 statute states of the Union. But yet we believe that as a U.S. citizen, we are part of the 50 states, the sovereign organic states, but we're not. We gave up that nationality when we went into adhesion contracts, from birth certificates from our parents to driver's licenses, marriage licenses. Every time we contracted with the government and they told you to sign under penalties of perjury that you're a U.S. citizen, we were programmed to believe that we were United States citizens, and that was an equivalent to saying you were an American national. But they are two different programs completely. So the method by which they use to have jurisdiction is to simply convince you that you're a subsidiary corporation of United States Inc. So whether it's criminal, civil, IRS, foreclosure, it doesn't matter, because these are all fabricated cases that the state or an agency thereof, or an agency of the federal government, is acting as the injured party. There is no real injured party. A corporation cannot feel pain. It cannot be injured. That's why the real party of interest must stand forward in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. So
one of our listeners raised the issue of what about state nationals, and I had this conversation with somewhat of an expert on sovereignty, and basically what I'm hearing from him is that we're not all sovereigns. Most of us are, but we'd have to, you know, prove that out with the MTOC or whatever it's called. But whether we are sovereign or not, lawfully a sovereign, we are state citizens, and from that perspective, we have unalienable rights. The two are not necessarily synonymous, is what I'm saying. Unalienable rights, you can have them without being necessarily a lawful sovereign. And when I'm talking about sovereign, I'm not just talking about a citizen who has the final say on the law. I'm referring to the original, what they perceived to be a sovereign at the time the nation was founded, those on the land, with the right documentation, and right blood. So I don't know if you make that distinction or not, but you know, this is a new distinction that's being raised by those who have studied the sovereignty issue. So I'll be quiet, and I don't know if I put that forth as an exact question, but what I'm looking for is what about a state national, whether they are quote a sovereign or not, would this apply to them?
Well, the power is reserved to the people of the state, and whatever has not been delegated to the government is reserved to the state. Whatever has been given to the state is reserved to the people. I think where we fail is allowing the government to make our school system believe that it all starts from the Constitution. The Constitution has, clauses in there that were not legally ratified, that are repugnant of the first 10 amendments, and they originate from the Articles of Confederation. Now, the Articles of Confederation is a very powerful article, articles, should I say, but if you read it, it's not a hard read. It's only about maybe 7 to 9 pages, depending upon who the author was that reduplicated it. And when you look at it, you ask yourself, why wasn't it repealed ever? Why is this one document not repealed? And the reason why, it has two words in it, perpetual, inviolability. Basically, it's inviolable. Some people call it inviolable. Some people call it inviolable. What that means is that there is nothing that can break that contract. It's there perpetually, forever. That is what Obama has attempted to put in the treaty that they're trying to do in Copenhagen right now, is use those same words. And a world government is also in there. So the reason why they have the tail wagging the dog on us right now is they don't want us to realize where the true power originated from, which is the Articles of Confederation. And if you read that document, you will see quite clearly. Now, there were some flaws in the Articles of Confederation, and not necessarily flaws as much as it was concerns that addressed from it, such as, each state placing a tariff on each other, competing against who's going to charge a higher tariff, and it didn't allow for specialization in a state. And what I mean by that is, if I was making oranges or apples, I could not use that advantage as a specialty state because somebody else who made tobacco would be charging me as a state tariff tax that was outrageous. So I said, I'll get back at you. We'll raise our taxes for our apples and oranges. So they had no problem with actually having the central government do the taxation to keep an equality there and have the tariffs, be equally distributed, so to speak, without us taxing each other to death. Another problem that they had faced was, should they incur the debt, the national debt? This is not our debt, but they con the people to believe that this debt is ours when it's a private corporation's debt. And it's been conned forever. Now, there's another misconception here where the people think that our children's children's children are going to pay this debt. Well, one of the best cons that they ever made is through inflation. When they start making, just like the dollar bill is based on supply and demand, if I make a ton of dollar bills, the buying power goes down, as we know. But then you'll see the price of product go up in inflation when they take away all the dollars. So as inflation occurs, they've already built in the tax into the actual products you're buying. That's why you see inflation. It's not your children's children that are going to be paying that tax. The only reason why they say that is because they're going to do the same thing to your children and the same thing to your child's child. But they're doing it to you right now. When they steal the wealth from America, they're stealing it by actually building the tax within the inflation of the product of the now through excise tax and through inflation. So So that product right now is paying for the money that the private Federal Reserve is stealing. So it is the now that's paying for it, and it will be the now later that will pay for it. What we have to realize is that we have the right to coin our own money in our states, and we gave all that up unauthorized. And that's why you have to fall back to where did the foundation start? Where is all of our rights truly reserved? Well, you're talking about a contract called the Articles of Confederation where they can't cancel it. And so they've put the energy in everybody believing that it's the Constitution that's preserving our rights. But the word Constitution represents the word debt. So all they had to do was coin the word Constitution to make everybody feel like it is a safe haven, but all we keep doing is voluntarily inheriting the restructure of the bankruptcy every time 70 years goes up. And right now, every 210 years, we are entitled to walk away from debt under the laws of the nations. So 210 years ended in 1999. All we had to do now is accept the bankruptcy and the restructure of it. So that's what they're trying to do right now, to get the next 210 years by restructuring us under the bankruptcy and changing the name. And right now the transitional name is called Homeland Security. And when you get to the North American Union, that will be the new name, the new bankruptcy structure. But the power, the reason why they want to take away the borders from Mexico and Canada is because they need more collateral. And the reason why they need more collateral is because the refinance of the bankruptcy is that much greater. So they need more future labor to tax. And so what you're sitting at is a situation right now where they need more bodies. And in order to do that, they've got to eliminate borders so they can tax the future labor of those people. The power starts from the republic, but the republic starts from the counties at large. And if you look up the word counties, if you just look up at large in a black law, you'll see that that's a superior word. And the counties itself is where it all begins. So they want it, you know, we had a huge, you know, dilemma about supporting that declaration that came out because, you know, I had 21 of 26 signatures. I was pushing that thing forward in my assembly, but I refused to not ask questions. And it was because I asked questions that they didn't approve of it or like the fact that I was asking intrusive questions. One of the questions I was asking is, are we restructuring the bankruptcy? You know, another concern I had was, why are we going from 434 congressmen to four elders? So although they tried to infiltrate our assembly, we didn't support the cause. But it's not – so our assembly in Illinois, we backed out. But it's not to say they're not going to go get signatures from somebody else, and from apparently – what they, you know, from what I've heard, they've gone out outside of our assembly, which is completely unlawful, and they've gotten signatures that represent our state. And I'm the appointed delegate for my state in my assembly for Illinois, and also under the RSAMI as well. I asked to take myself off as a coordinator, and they have brought somebody from Wisconsin to come into our state. A lot of bad things occurred with that, but it opened up our eyes because if we don't have transparency now, we're never going to have it. And I'm a big believer in definitions of actual words that are going to be in a contract, and that declaration had a lot of words that were questionable. So I asked them for a definitions page so there was transparency, and that created a huge smear campaign. And the answer was, do what your mother told you and look it up. That was their answer. We already have a tyranny in government and environment. We don't need to switch one for the other. And right now, it used to be a concern that they said, oh, yeah, we want to do the county assemblies. And all of a sudden they changed their mind. No, no, we don't need that anymore. We just want your signatures. That's all we want is your signatures. When people say all we want is your signatures, we're not learning from our lessons of the past if we don't stop for a second and say, that's all you want from me? Why? Why is that all you want from me? You know, and I want to go back, Terry, to answering your question about experience in the courthouse. When that judge stopped me and looked at the plaintiff's attorney at the time, even though I was the plaintiff, and she said, you know him? Yes, I do. He's the defendant. He's the debtor. He's the guy that's delinquent, blah, blah, blah. What do you like? I would like you to remand this back to the state court, please. So the judge says, I'll take that under advisement. Now, if you know what take that under advisement means, you can't take anything under advisement until you heard both sides. Now, as you know, I only got through my name in a few words, right? So I told the judge, I said, listen, I didn't even get a chance to talk. The very first thing that the judge said is, I'm going to put my finger on the U.S. Marshal button if you say another word. So, in other words, I don't even have the right to speak. And she already took it under advisement. And then she states, well, I'm going to take it under advisement and remand this case back to the state. And we're going to give you 21 days to respond if you don't like it. And that was it. I went home, and the very next day I already had the order that the case was remanded back to the state, and they mailed it to the state. But yet they gave me 21 days, so they already broke their own promise. So I decided to take my witnesses and do criminal complaints for treason against the federal judge. I had 6 witnesses, and I entered that in. Well, what she did when I was in court, the only words I was able to say to that judge before she stopped the court hearing was, I said, Judge, that plaintiff's attorney cannot be here in court. He's in contempt because I already have a cured negative averment. He didn't respond to my affidavit. He's exhausted all administrative remedies. Him just being in court asking you to remand this case, he's in contempt of court. So you know that letter I got the next day, what it said is, the plaintiff's motion to remand the case back to the state's been denied. So you think, well, that's good. But then she turns around and says, sua sponte, the case has been remanded to the state. Well, the word sua sponte means of your own free will and motion. So when I decided to answer, what she did is she answered me. I want you to hear those two words again. Of your own free will, meaning she backed the attorney up by saying that she denied his motion because he shouldn't have been there under contempt. So to cover his butt, she denied him. Then she turned around and said, I'll make the motion myself, and I'll send this back to the state myself. I don't need his motion. Well, sua sponte, again, means of your own free will and motion. Who is she motioning to? She's motioning to me. Guess who's the judge? I am.
We're gonna about 5 minutes or 6 minutes. We're gonna take a break on the hour. I just wanted to give you a heads up on that. I recognize that you're not a member of the bar, and some of the people that are listening are feeling like they're listening to someone who is, and I just want to make sure they understand that you're not that. And obviously, you did not learn all of this stuff overnight. And I know that you've been doing seminars for people, but you might just want to, you know, let the people recognize how you did come about learning this. And some people are also asking if you have a blog or how they should go about understanding this.
Well, Terry, I started off based on IRS. It didn't start off in the law. I was 21 years old. I'm 37. I was 21 years old, and I was a finance guy in the car business. I used to work as a finance director. I made good money. I was, you know, that's what I studied was finance. And so I used to finance leases. I used to finance people's vehicles. That was my main job, was finance. One day somebody comes up to me, and we were sitting inside during lunch, and I said, listen, you know, I got a huge tax bill, and this is, you know, I'm going to have to cut a big check. Can you hear me? I keep hearing buttons.
Yeah, I think it's on your end. It cuts you out when it happens.
Okay. So anyway, what happens is You know, the guy tells me, I don't know why you're even cutting a check. Taxes are illegal. You shouldn't have to pay for them. I said, what kind of taxes? And they said, well, taxes on your labor. And I said, ridiculous. And I was a big patriot already by 21. I believed in my country. I believed in supporting everything, taxes. So I'm like, you know, I was very distraught about his challenge to me that, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. And, you know, of course I was young and I was like, well, you know what? I'm going to prove you wrong. And he said, do whatever you want. You'll find it out in the end. So what I did is I went and bought, you know, the 1994 United States code books. And I started going through it just to prove him wrong. And what I started doing is finding myself going into a rabbit hole that just got deeper and deeper. And all of a sudden I realized everything I knew was a lie. And that's when I really got into it. So I've been studying it for almost 16 years.
Well, obviously, you're the exception. Not too many people out there, even if they want to go pro se, are going to spend 16 years studying the topic. In some cases, they won't have that opportunity. So how does somebody gain an understanding of this and not have to spend 16 years studying it like you did?
Well, and that's why I had my seminars, because, you know, people that I kind of look up to and I look forward to. First off, I had a lot of people, it was thinning me out because people would ask me for help and you don't want to say no. And it started burning me out. And it got to the point where I said, listen, if I'm going to help people, if I really got to reach out, I had to do it to way more people than just them thinning me out with 6-7 cases at a time. So that's where I got into the seminar idea. And what, you know, somebody like Anthony Robbins, for example, one of the things he does is, you know, he takes somebody who has 20 years of experience, cuts all the fat, and in one you'll learn everything, you know, on what not to do in 6 months to a year. That's kind of the same concept. I wanted to just point where all the laws were so people can just take off running. And I've already made templates for all this stuff. So, because I've done it. And
are you charging for your seminars, or is this something you do out of the kindness of your heart?
Well, whenever somebody, you know, needs some help that they can't afford it, I tell them, you know, if they got money to gift, they gift it. But the seminars itself, the first time I wound up in a negative, even though 65 people showed up, because I didn't know really what I was doing, so I had to come up with money out of my pocket. But it turned out okay in the end because I did sell some DVDs and it wound up becoming in the positive. So you learn that there's a major expense if you want to kind of reach out that way. So you start to understand. So what I did is I made my sale price, it is $300 for the seminar, but if you prepay, it's $200. And that's like an early bird special, and it goes to $250 and $300. What it does for me is it secures the fact that I don't have to get left over with the burden of a negative amount. And, you know, from there I've been training. But this is going to be my third seminar coming up. I have I just got back from my second one in California, in Ontario. We had 50 people there. There was 2 bar card attorneys and like 4 lawyers. But out of the 50 people that were there, the one in Chicago was about 65. And after the California one, they want me to go back in 30 days for San Diego, Arizona, New Jersey, and New York. So it's really – the whole idea for me is to get people to know exactly where to go, because there's so many different laws. Somebody who doesn't know the law, oh, do I look at the Uniform Commercial Code? Do I look at the USC Code? Do I look at Federal Rules of Civil Procedure? Do I look at Administrative Code for the local state? We just show you right off the bat how you're going to win this. And does that mean you're going to win no matter what? No, because you're dealing with criminals. These judges are criminals. There's only a few good ones out there. There are good ones, but there's only a few. Because they work for the banks. They don't work for you. And that's the problem. Our remedies, we don't even have, you know, there are good police officers out there, and just as much as they're good attorneys and good judges, but the problem is, none of them work for us anymore. You can't go to your local police without them making the state the victim whenever you file a complaint. The state's not the victim. I'm the victim. How can you benefit from that? But yet they always make the state the victim. You can't go to the
Mike, can you hang in here for about a 2 or 3 minute break with us and come back after the break?
Sure.
Appreciate it. We'll be right back with the balls in our mind.
The Lord picked up and dusted off their swords, vowed to set the captive free, and not let Satan have one more. What if the church, for heaven's sake, finally stepped up to the plate, took a stand upon God's promise, and stormed hell's rusty gates? What if his people prayed, and those who bear his name would only seek his faith, yeah, and turn from their if we prayed for those raised up to lead the way, then maybe kids in school could play and unborn children see light of day. What if the light that we pursue came from a hunger for the truth? What if the family turned to Jesus, stopped asking Oprah what to do? What if his people prayed, and those who bear his name would only seek his faith, yeah, and turn from their own ways? He said that he would hear. His promise has been made. He answered loud and clear, yeah. If only we would pray.
Welcome back to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here with my co-host, Red Beckman, and our guest tonight, Mike DeCosola from the great state of Illinois. Mike, I'm sure you probably had some thoughts. You want to maybe fill in some blanks after our discussion before break?
Certainly. Well, what I'd like to do is finish off using that example of that court case. So we entered in a criminal probable cause complaint with approximately 5 or 6 witnesses into an order. See, when she said sua sponte, what she really did is she told me she needs my permission. That was what the motion was about, which confirms the forbearance. The forbearance in the affidavit of negative averment opportunity to cure and counterclaim was the value consideration, and it was a simple contract under international law. Because that is a statute staple contract, which now falls under admiralty in the Constitution, where we have the right to contract. So what becomes the law when you have the right to contract? Well, the judge no longer can be a judge. She has a ministerial duty to perform the laws that are on the contract. Therefore, the drafter of the document becomes the judge. And when they don't respond to your affidavit, they have confessed to admit to your counts, and they have agreed to your contract, your international statute staple contract, which is your complaint, your negative averment. So when she put in her motion, what she was saying is, here's my suggestion. Now let's see what you know. So we entered in response to that, that her motion application is denied, that the order, that the notice of removal as is now entered as an order of removal, and that I have now entered an order of default against the party. So basically, I just said, I'm removing it, I'm putting in the default, and you are denied for your application to send it back as a remand. Now, 3 days later, approximately, we get this immediate call to court, and it's the attorney again. The attorney received these orders. Now, these orders got him so distressed that he immediately asked for an emergency hearing. And his motion this time was a motion to strike all post-remand filings, which means we need you, judge, to strike everything he entered after you already said we could bring it back to the state, after you remanded it to state. So when I showed up for court, I said, you know, my name is Mike DeCosta, upper and lower case. I'm a real sovereign man, secured party creditor under sua juris. I already ordered a default in this case. Why am I here? Just, you know, and the judge stopped me, and she said, sir, and I have this on transcript if anybody ever wants to see it. Sir, let me ask the defense counsel a question. Now, if you remember, what was I before? I was the defendant, remember?
Right.
Now she's calling them the defendant. She said, let me ask the defense counsel a question. Now, don't forget, I have treason charges against her, along with my orders of denying her order and my order of default. She shrugs her shoulders with her palms open side to side and her head jolted forward and says to the defendant's counsel, why are you doing this to me? You know I have no authority. This case has wanted jurisdiction. It's hereby dismissed. So she literally says in the transcript, I have no power over this case. And that's because you have the right to contract. And the law becomes the contract, and you access common law through admiralty. So that was just one example of us winning a case.
So what happened to it being remanded to the state?
It can't be remanded lawfully. Once a judge dismisses the case, she's discharged the other end of the books. But now what happens is, The attorney, who is as corrupt as the day, you know, as the dawn of day when corruptness started, went back to the state and told the judge that he wanted a conference hearing, even though the federal judge ruled that the debt was discharged. It's over with. The federal judge denied it. So what he did is he showed up a court and switched the judge on me. The new judge didn't have anything in the file. And he told the new judge that the case was already remanded and never said anything other than that. And they had ex parte communications, and that judge put an order of default against me. Now, that's a federal crime. That's called fraud on the court, inland piracy, collateral attack. These are all Title 18 violations. But you can't – where are we going right now for remedy? You go to the state prosecutor, and he don't want to turn in his brother. Who's his brother? Well, his brother is his union card holder. They're protecting each other. So the state prosecutor don't want to prosecute. So what do you need? You need a de jure attorney general. You need a de jure cabinet. And you need, on top of that de jure cabinet, underneath it, you need to get your counties at large. So the instructions come from the county level. You need rangers who have more seniority than a sheriff, a coroner, and police officers who are on the de jure soil, in order to have your law enforcement. But you don't need to step into any of their domain because it's all illegal. We already had all these rights reserved for us. As a matter of fact, they use those rights against us. What do you think the TSA is? What do you think the U.S. Marshals are? What do you think the sheriffs are? Those are all de facto militia under the Posse Comitatus Act. That's what they are. So the very laws that they afforded us, where they said where our forefathers reserved it for us, they're using those very laws to be to make our country an occupied country and us the enemy of the state. And we are not executing our own laws that were there for us, but they're using those very laws against us.
Red, you've been mighty quiet for a long time.
Well, I've heard a lot of this before, and of course, there isn't one attorney in 100 that has learned any of this kind of stuff in law school. Law schools, they just teach these guys what the big names, the bankers, lawyers, and all that. But I want to back up just a little bit. The founders didn't call, we talk about the Constitution. They didn't call it the Constitution at all. They called it a Declaration. And of course, they did not. You see, they had been under Magna Carta back prior to the War of Independence.
Correct.
And they did not discard Magna Carta. Magna Carta is still cited in court decisions today, as well as the Articles of Confederation. And there has been, since 1215, when Magna Carta came into force, there has been a lot of trial and error to try to develop a better system. And, of course, the system that we're in right now really, it had deteriorated very quickly after the original ratification and everything. And, of course, it didn't help when the British in the War of 1812 burnt Washington, D.C., and they were able to destroy all of the original documents. And we had a real serious situation then developed in the time period 1830 to 1840, 1845, 50. And it was brought back on track basically by people getting busy and pamphleteering. Some of the history of the time says that there was about 600. They didn't call them newsletters. They were handwritten papers and with ideas and such and principles that were circulated in the colonies, or the states, I should say, at that point. And they got things back in order. Now, the problem, of course, that we have lived with when the Constitution, we call it the Constitution, and I call it the Constitution so everybody knows what I'm talking about, by 1795, lawyers had already gained control of the legislative branch of government, and that, of course, is what led to the what we call the missing 13th Amendment. Sam Bitz in Montana had found that missing 13th Amendment in the early 1980s. And that was just an amendment to the Constitution to keep lawyers out of the legislative branch of government. Lawyers were to be officers of the court, which meant that the separation of powers, the principle, the concept of separation of powers, made it so that lawyers, as officers of the court, could not cross over and also be legislators. And so there was a lot of mischief, a lot of lawyer misbehavior, outright schemes and conspiracies and all of that. And we are living with that yet today. And, of course, Lincoln was an attorney. And Lincoln has been put up on a pedestal in our education system and all. And I remember when I was in high school that I did not like Lincoln at that point. And I was outnumbered, of course, in the history classrooms because I was the only one that didn't like Lincoln. I didn't like what he stood for and the things he did. And, of course, we have not gained anything. Things have really deteriorated further. And until today, we're just absolutely lawyers, not so much the Republican Party in Washington, D.C., but all of the leadership in the Democratic Party is all Bar Association attorneys. And they really don't belong there. And, of course, I didn't mention that the one we call the missing 13th Amendment was dropped through the cracks somewheres back there, and they really don't know when and how. But they do have copies of the U.S. Constitution as late as 1868 or 69 that list the original 13th Amendment. But the lawyers, I can assure you, they're the ones that did the scheming and the mischief to get rid of that original 13th Amendment. And of course, Lincoln came along with the involuntary servitude that we have today. But anyway, we have such a record of how attorneys have just deliberately subverted the system. And, of course, I was the instigator of all the research on the 16th and the 17th Amendment. Sam Bitz in Montana, of course, was the expert on all of that. But I'm the guy that got all these people involved with our meetings in Montana back in the 70s. And the 16th and the 17th Amendment, and of course the 14th, are all examples of subversive activity on the part of Bar Association attorneys. And the system now has become so corrupt. Mike mentioned that all judges are criminal, and I would have to disagree with him. He thinks there's some good ones out there, but I think that we can prove beyond any kind of doubt whatever that every federal judge in the United States of America today is a felon. They are guilty of the felonies. Because when we noticed them of the 16th Amendment fraud and the 17th Amendment fraud, we were complying. We were complying. I corrected Bill Benson's affidavit to the court in a case, and I brought out, I rewrote it for them, and Bill had the help of an attorney that did his affidavit, and when I read it, they gave it to me to check it, and I said, well, you've missed the most important thing, and that is that you have failed to put in your affidavit the fact that you are complying with Title 18, Section 4, misprison of felony. And that's a law in the criminal code that says that if you know of a crime, you have to bring it to the attention of a judge or other proper authority, even military. And I had put Judge Batten, the senior federal judge in Montana, I had put him on notice of the 16th Amendment fraud in 1980, in the fall of 1980, we already knew, because of Senate Document 240, we knew that the 16th Amendment had not been ratified properly, and that it was not, had no right whatever to be attached to our Constitution. I had put the federal judge on notice, and when Bill Benson, which was in 1984 or 85, when he put his affidavit in there, I told him, I said, you've got to put it in there where you are making sure that they understand that you're in compliance with Title 18, Section 4, misprison of felony. The law requires you to bring it to the attention of a judge. And that's exactly what Bill Benson did. That's what I had done in 1980, 5 years prior to Bill Benson putting it in. And we have done this with federal judges all over this country, and we have not had one single federal judge that has moved on it and done what he is required to do by law. We put them on notice, and they just ignored the notice, and therefore they are guilty of a felony, every single one of them. Now, we can get them for obstruction of justice. We've got, I don't know how many judges that we can get for obstruction of justice, because we brought this to their attention in open court. And of course, they have, judges have put in these motions in limine ahead of trials, where they thought that they were going to be confronted with the evidence on the 16th and 17th Amendments. And the judges have signed these orders in limine to keep the defendant from bringing in this evidence. Well, that's obstruction of justice. That's another serious federal crime. So there's all kinds of crimes that these judges are committing. So, Mike, I just hope that he putting all of this down in an orderly fashion. I don't think this is where our remedy is. I don't think that this is going to be the magic wand that we need. I don't think it'll go that far. What we have, of course, is a battlefield in this thing, this confrontation between we the people and the government. This battlefield is, there's fronts on this war. There's fronts on all around. The government is being hammered from so many angles at this point in time. And, we're being fairly successful, very successful as far as I know, challenging the tax court and just using the Seventh Amendment and challenging the judge with the fact that they have a conflict of interest. The tax court is a sitting duck for us anyway, because the tax court, the judge, you can't have constitutional due process of a jury trial. And the judge makes all finding of fact and conclusions of law. However, if you confront him with the fact that he has a conflict of interest because he is a government employee, which makes him an agent of the government, he is a government agent. He is a government agent, and he is denied impartiality by that conflict of interest, and he cannot make a finding of fact and conclusion of law. When we confront him with it, we've been very successful in closing down the tax court. And really, we should be able to close down the tax court within the next couple of years. The way it's going, it's kind of contagious, this concept of confronting them with their conflict of interest. And, of course, that will work. Of course, it'll do wonders for you in a criminal case. Confronting the judge with the fact that they are government agents. And, of course, we also confront them with the fact that a Seventh Amendment common law jury is the highest court in our land. And there isn't a judge or the nine justices of the Supreme Court are just nine government agents. corkscrew lawyers. And these guys, when you confront them with their conflict of interest, they don't know what to do. And so anyway, that you see, we've got all these different fronts. People out there all over the country are coming up with these battle plans, and they're going after these outlaws, this criminal syndicate that we've got. They're getting hit from so many angles. The sheriff in Wyoming, I haven't heard whether Dr. Kate's going to be on tonight or not, but the sheriffs in Wyoming won that case in federal district court, defining the power of the sheriff, and they can keep the county or the federal agents. They can't go into Wyoming and just do what they've been able to do in the past. And so that's just another front out there that we're using it all over this country. And my goodness, it's pretty exciting. But you see what Mike has done, and the people he's working with. I have that friend there in Montana that he's such a genius on this stuff, and he understands. His comprehension ability is so keen and so great, and he has unraveled a great deal of this history. But Mike has stepped right up there, and he's unraveling. I call it a spider web, and we've just been untangling that spider web, one strand at a time, you might say. But all of these different fronts in this war are they're all heading for the same goal, and that is to get the people back in the driver's seat in this country, and having our foot on the throttle and the clutch, and we're going to drive this thing. We're not going to have Congress driving us. And so I guess I've said enough.
Mike, before you comment to what Red has said, I want to mention, you mentioned what Red, earlier today in our conversation, you were talking about what Red calls the pecking order and the way that it was designed to be and the fact that it's been flip-flopped, starting obviously with the true sovereign God and then the people and then Constitution and then government underneath that and the various branches thereof underneath that. I don't know, Mike, have you seen Red's seminar? He has an hour and a half long seminar regarding the two-law system and the pecking order. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't, but I think we're probably on the same page. The laws of parity, right? In terms of
how's that again? How's that again?
The laws of parity, where you have it's supposed to be, how you were just to reiterate, you were saying God, man, state, government has been flipped, and it's government, state, man, God at this point.
Yeah, well, the American people have no concept of how, the proper order of authority in this country. And, of course, I blame the preachers in the pulpits for a lot of that because they're teaching the people in their pews that we are to be subject to the higher powers, and they say the government is the higher power. Well, that's totally reversed from what it's supposed to be. George W. Bush and Obama and all the rest of them, those guys aren't exempt. Romans, the 13th chapter, does not exempt those political leaders from God's law, the higher powers. And a public servant has more higher powers over them than you or I. We just have our our Creator God as a higher power over us. But Obama has us, we the people, as above him, and he is under the Constitution. We are above the Constitution. You and I are above it. And the grand jury and the petit jury are above the Constitution. But all of government, all of those 435 congressmen and 100 U.S. senators, all of those 11 or 1,200 federal judges, those people are all under the Constitution. And that's a higher power, them, and they are to be subject to the higher powers. And I call it the pecking
Red, Red,
order.
Red, can you hold that thought for just a minute? We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. Mike, I hope you can stick in here with us for just a minute.
Sure.
Thank you for that beautiful song, Mama Cooks. This is Terry Dodd, and Red and I are speaking with our guest tonight, Mike DeCosola, a member of the Illinois County Assemblies. Red, I think you were getting close to finishing your thought, but I cut you off, and my apologies.
Well, if Mike hasn't seen any of my presentations, I'd sure recommend that he go to Google and click on videos and just type in Red Beckman. And the one you want to watch is, it's labeled L.A. Lawman. And there's an hour and a half, there's 2 hours, but the fourth half hour, well, this L.A. Lawman was an organization that set up a network of cable stations down in Southern California back in early 90s. We did this tape in 93, so it's got some age. It's almost old enough to vote now. It might give you some ideas to use in your seminars. How that you know, my charts, there's nothing copyrighted. It's all free, and so I've been doing this since way back in the 70s, and so those charts and that wild animal I have that I use for visual aid. When you see that on that tape, I still use it. What few times I use it anymore. At 81, I'm not doing much. I can assure you. You'll see some ideas, I think, that you might find useful, because you've got to communicate with people that have just their brains have been so messed up by the public education, the government media, the government churches, everything out there in the way of information has been tampered with, and it's more propaganda than anything. So you have to overcome that in your seminars. So I hope you'll watch that, because you'll see how I try to get to the very basics. Every flock of chickens in the barnyard have an order of authority, and the biologists call it the pecking order. Every corporation has its pecking order of authority. Every military unit has their order of authority, and all societies are the same way. They will have a pecking order of one kind or another. In Africa, the villages, they've got the witch doctor, I don't know if they call them witch doctors or what they call them now. But anyway, every society will have some kind of a pecking order or order of authority. And the one that we've got that we live in today has been turned upside down, and we've got to change it.
Mike, one thing that we could all learn from Red, and that is how to boil things down to a level where the common guy, Joe Sixpack, can understand the message. And that's one thing you'll get from watching that video. Mike, we've had a lot of requests, and they've been asking me for a good hour now. I better get it out so they'll get off my back. But we've had a lot of requests for people wanting to know if you've got a blog site or a website or some way that people can find out more information about what you're doing and how to contact you.
Well, first off, Red, I'll be happy to take a look at that video. Thank you for pointing that out to me. I'll enjoy that, and I'll take a look at it for sure. Terry, to give you an idea of what's going on right now, we are working on a website. It's not up. But if somebody does want to just communicate with me and ask a few questions, I don't mind giving out my email. It's my whole name. It's mike.decosola@yahoo. And my last name is D as in David, I-C-O-S-O-L-A. I'll be happy to answer questions if somebody has them until the site's up. But I think if from a standpoint of discussion with changing the shift a little bit in terms of where I believe the remedy lies is, we're all looking, as you guys said, for the silver bullet, but we have to go back and as
as Red has stated, that it starts with the Magna Carta. Before that, it was the Bible. And what we have to look at is where all the laws stem from and where our power resides. What we need to do is collect. I've looked at both sides. I've looked at the Sam Kennedy, Tim Turner side. I've looked at the R. Sammy side. I've listened and learned about a little bit about your side on the Continental Congress. And what I've learned to see is we are a house divided, and the Bible states that a house divided will fall. I believe the Lord has put a piece of one key in each of these pods of patriots' hands that will make the ultimate finished key. Because when I look at Continental Congress, I look at an organization that really has, they're on the ball, and they have their delegates set up. And then I look at the R. Sammy website, and they have all, on their website, they have all the assembly calls in audio form. You can download the MP3s at any time. They list all the states and all the counties of each state where you can actually log on and become an assembly member. They are organizing all the counties at large under the judicial districts of 10, which allows us to have, the Supreme Court will only act if there is civil order. Civil order comes from we the people, we're the power, and we delegated some to the state, some to the government. But if we somehow take, I believe, the hybrid of all the hard work you've done on the Continental Congress side with you guys and Bob, and put that together with the R. Sammy side, I believe we have a force to be reckoned with. And I believe that we're staying within the biblical sense of the word, a house not divided. It's just a matter of merging. I believe there's a key element to each side of you that I've looked at that will ultimately become the perfect solution. You've already have your delegates appointed. They already have theirs appointed. But as I've stated, if we go based on the Constitution, Constitution says that you only need one representative per state, and then it says, you know, every 30,000 people. But the Articles of Confederation states that we only need a minimum of 2 up to 7. So there wouldn't be, in my eyes, any disruption as to the delegates already appointed on one side of the camp versus the other, because in the end, you each have one side or one delegate for each of your states. Combine the forces, use the structure already established on the R. Sammy for the de jure side where the power resides, because the de jure is the power. It is the ultimate power. It is the lawful remedy and method. It is what's been reserved for us. We're not usurping through ultra vires any positions of power. We're not taking over any federal municipal corporations. We're not doing anything unlawful such as, you know, a corporate takeover. You know, we're not doing anything of such. What we're doing is we're filling in a vacant position. And once we lawfully fill in that vacant position, we're able to go about using the Constitution. Where, you know, for example, in Illinois, they have the entire cabinet already, where they took the land patent owners who are the true electors, and the electors are the true voters of our cabinet. And these people have been appointed by actual electors of our land. And with the counties at large, we've assembled the county assembly. We are the true government in our state. Although not recognized by our de facto side, once our fundamental foundation is established and we have our de jure notaries, we're able to be in a position of strength that was always there for us without disrupting the order that is already in place, because we are the authority, and we don't need to go into somebody else's house to do it. We have our own authority. So when we look at things like remedies, you know, have you heard about the wager of law?
That's a new one on me.
Okay. New on me.
If you both look into the Black Law Dictionary, it's a very intriguing definition. Because what the wager of law is, it's a common law remedy based on debt where a defendant walks into court, and in open court, he testifies by stipulating under oath that he does not owe the debt, but he brings with him 11 other witnesses that concur that his testimony is truth and that he doesn't owe the debt. And you've created wager of law, and that's a specific law made for under common law to challenge a debt. These are simple remedies under common law, but in order to access our common law, we have to, you know, there's something called a jurata as well. Rather than a jurat, you have a jurata. You know, a jurata is 12 signatures, you know, on the common law side. And when you're able to have a de jure assembly, you're able to have de jure notaries. If you can get three de jure notaries, you have the power to issue warrant arrests that are superior than the de facto notaries. Because we have no authority in the de facto side, our remedies are mere pleas. And if you think about it, there's been successful sides. You know, there's pros and cons. We've had people that are successful in cases, and we've had unsuccessful cases. But it's a give and take because they try to keep us appeased while their ultimate goal is to destruct. Because what they're doing is what we call wanton acts of willful misconduct through economic treason. And that's when we go from misprison, you know, as Red was saying, misprison is contempt, but misprison of a felon is when you know of a crime and do nothing of it. Misprison of treason is when you actually handle the crime yourself and you're in a position of office that you're supposed to protect. You know, this is what we entered in against the federal judge, is misprison of treason. These remedies are there, and they're Title 18 violations all over the place that we can go through. Endless counts, you know, from inland piracy to collateral attack to misprison of felon, misprison of treason, fraud on the court, practicing law from the bench. You know, they took an oath, you know, under 28 U.S.C. 454, and right there in that realm, in order to maintain immunity, they have to be in good standing. Good standing is only when they're acting in an impartial method, like Red was saying. They're not acting impartially. They're partial. They're biased, and at this point they're so conceited that they don't even recuse themselves when you tell them to. So what they're doing is they're impersonating an officer, and they're doing it by way of military. I mean, these military flags that are flying in with, you know, that are flying inside these courtrooms, sitting there with the gold fringe under flag law. You know, Title IV of the United States Code distinguishes. What our flag is supposed to be, and it's not a gold fringe. Their fringe is a flag of war. So we have been in war with them, but it hasn't been with the sword. This is where the pen is mightier than the sword. This is a war of the pens. It's not a war of the swords. And right now, in order to regain our authority, we must use the superior authority that was always reserved for us, vacant and waiting for us to occupy. So what I would do is I would urge, you know, any listener and yourselves to go to an RSAMMI website. Go to rsammi.net. It's rsammi.net. Take a look at their site. They'll talk about rangers for law enforcement. They'll talk about the assemblies. They'll talk about all the different aspects of creating your judicial process. I'm a chief justice in my county assembly. I've been appointed such. There's two other judges underneath me. Once we have our judicial county assembly, we're able to remand the cases lawfully. I will be able to speak under letters rogatory from one judge to another, saying that this case that you have is one of my assembly members. You need to remand that case back to my state because it's out of your jurisdiction. Here's the letters rogatory to communicate from one judge to another. You are a de facto, I'm a de jure. I have seniority over you. Please transfer this case to me. Once I receive it, I will be able to look at it and say, this case is a frivolous filing, dismissed. So these are just
what does an acronym SAMMI represent?
It's a good word, and I can't remember what it is now, but it is an acronym, and I can't remember off the top of my head, but they have it on there if you want to look at it. The most important thing is to listen what their assemblies are about, because you'll get to hear their training seminars, Like, they have training over the phone on how to do your assembly, how to set up your assembly. And the beauty is you all, on the Continental Congress side, you're very organized. And it would be just a mere transition to change it from de facto to de jure. And to merge these two forces as one, where everybody registers on the RSAMI as sovereigns in their counties at large, we can escalate this so quickly. And I just see this balance between the two of you. It's so exciting to me when I see the huge benefit that you would both bring to each other. And right now for our assembly, we've been working on an amicus curiae briefing, which basically is an outline of what we believe our declaration should look like. And we're supporting the Articles of Confederation. But what we would like to do is nothing like what, you know, the Sam Kennedy did, whereby they kept everything secret and nobody could look at it. You guys have your own stuff. There should be no reason why we can't have a meeting of the minds where all your hard work can collectively wrap around the RSAMI side with what their decree is, and you know where we can pull out our declaration, our amicus curiae briefing, and say, here's our idea. And then collectively all say, we like this, we don't like that, you forgot about this, and post it on the internet. Let the world see it. We have nothing to hide. This is all about transparency. Have a definitions page. Break down each word. Let the public know what they're reading. There are so many different definitions, so many different dictionaries. Which dictionary does this definition pertain to? Because the same word, if written in a noun, verb, or adjective, can have a different meaning in just one dictionary book. Now go pick four more dictionary books, and now we hold interpretation. Interpretation is our biggest problem that we had with our forefathers. Because our forefathers didn't distinguish transparency, which left the attorneys an opportunity to bastardize every word through interpretation. We need to learn from that and strengthen ourselves and not tell or not to plead, but to tell and demand. You know, they say you must plead to the court. We are begging. Why are we begging? We're in a position of weakness. We should be in a position of strength. And with what you have, you've done so much work, so much dedication. You have such an unbelievable track record of history, and all the wonderful things you've brought to the table over the years is invaluable. Your organization, your skills, combine that with what's already organized in the RSAMI. I think we have the tools to escalate this exponentially. It would be an analogy like two major companies merging. Once other small patriot communities see that, and it's been done properly and then announced, you're going to see small pods of patriot communities want to join. And that's where we're not a house divided anymore. It's not my ideas better than yours, and the egos fall away. They fall wayside. Because in the patriot community, there's a lot of ego, and we need to all unload that and look at the benefits of each camp, so to speak. Because we're all after the same goals, but they have us at each other's necks, and they have us, well, who's better than who? The best way to have us not collectively work together is to have us fighting from within. It's under the art of war, under Sun Tzu. You know, you want to destroy your enemy, you do it from within. That is what they attempted to do with Sam Kennedy. You know, and right now, I see two sides of two different camps that can merge as one, and I see huge benefit from it. And that's just my take.
Well, that's a very interesting take, and I like a lot of what you said. I'm sorry that we actually had the de jure president of the Third Continental Congress listening up until the last break, and he's over on the East Coast, so he broke away, but I'm going to get him to listen to this last part, because I believe that there's a lot of merit in what you just said, and I agree with you. We need to grasp the grassroots organization of the assemblies to go along with what we're doing. And it, in essence, contains a lot of the elements of the well-regulated state militias in the fact that the way it's organized from the grassroots up. And that, of course, I think would be the next step of incorporating it once you get the authorization, the proper authorization to do that. But we've got about 4 minutes left, and one of the things that I wanted to come back to that I think is worth discussing between you and Red. Red, you've used, isn't it Title 18 that you've used to go after the judges when...
Well, I used Title 42, suing for damages, and then of course, when I sued the federal judge here in Montana, I had been damaged severely by his actions, and in the complaint that I filed, I listed several. You know, very critical sections of the U.S. Title 18, the criminal code, crimes that the judge had committed. And I listed them in the case, in the complaint. And of course, I was suing for damages. And on the front page, the cover sheet, in the right-hand column where it's mostly vacant except for the case number that they put in at the top and the judge that is assigned the case, I wrote in there, I put in there all facts to be tried by Seventh Amendment common law jury. And of course, that is what... got that case docketed with the U.S. Supreme Court, and you know, I told the Supreme Court that the only authority they had was to remand that case back to the Federal District Court in Billings, Montana, for that Seventh Amendment common law jury trial, and I specifically pointed out to the Supreme Court that they had a conflict of interest and in that they were government employees, and therefore they could not make findings of fact or conclusions of law, and that only a Seventh Amendment common law jury could make the findings of fact and conclusions of law to make the decision in this controversy between me and the federal judge. And, of course, that case was docketed in August of 1996, and they haven't heard it yet to this day, and they never will, because they are criminals, and that's one way that they can avoid dealing with things that are very, very important. But the day is coming at some point here where they may not ever rule on it. However, of course, the judge that I sued has cashed in his chips, and he's gone to see the big judge, the highest judge, and so it's basically, as far as I'm concerned, the case is rather moot at this point. But it was docketed, and the lawyers that know about it, you know, they say, well, of course, I have to say this. The case was docketed the first part of August of 96. In December of 96, the Solicitor General noticed the parties to the action that he was not going to oppose me. Basically, he said I was absolutely correct in what I was saying, and therefore he would not defend the government and the judge. And so,
We got about 30 seconds, and I want to give Mike the last word.
Yes. I want to say sick 'em, Mike.
Well, I will say this. I'm proud to be a part of this conversation. I thank you all for all the
Keep talking.
And I think together, as one, we won't be a house divided, and we all can.
You may be an ambassador to England or France. You may.
Mike, you're breaking up. Thank you very much. It was a great show. Appreciate you coming on. We'd like to have you back because I believe there's a lot more to talk about, especially more to talk about what you mentioned last weekend. So good night, everybody. See you next week. Thanks, Red.
Yeah. Good night.
Good night.
Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're going to have to serve some. Maybe a rock and roll addict dancing on the stage. Money, drugs at your command. Women in a cage. You may be a businessman or some high degree thief. They may call you doctor or they may call you chief. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are. You're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
You may be a state trooper, it may be a young turk, maybe the head of some bigger TV network. You may be rich or poor, you may be blind or lame, maybe living in another country. Under another name, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are. You're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Maybe you're a construction worker working on a home. Might be living in a mansion. You might live in a dome. You may own guns and you may even own tanks. You may be somebody's landlord. You may even own banks. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Maybe a city councilman taking bribes on the side. Maybe working in a barber shop, you may know how to cut hair. And maybe somebody's mistress, maybe somebody's heir. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Might like to wear cotton, might like to wear silk, might like to drink whiskey, might like to drink milk, might like to eat caviar, you might like to eat bread. Maybe sleeping on the floor, sleeping in a king-size bed. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed. You may call me Zimmy. You may call me RJ. You may call me Ray. You may call me anything. No matter what you say, you're still gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Yes, you're gonna have to serve somebody. And it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.